chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them.
But we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
Hey everyone, welcome back. It is fairy tale month. Last week we covered Cinderella, and this week we're going to cover Beauty and the Beast, maybe? We'll get into it. Hey Janelle, how you doing?
Hey Eliza, I'm pretty good and shocked at how much I didn't like this movie.
That's going to make this great because I love this movie, so I think we're going to have a real interesting discussion.
Welcome to a rousing debate, listeners.
What didn't you like about the movie? Oh, well, we'll get into that later. Ignore that.
But I will give a preview that one of my big takeaways from this movie was, wow, 2007 was a time. Wasn't it a time?
It was a time.
All right, let's get into the movie of this week, Penelope. Penelope, the year of our Lord, 2007. Eliza, here's our Google summary. Born with the snout of a pig, young Penelope Wilhern, played by Christina Ricci, spends life a virtual prisoner in her home. Believing that the only way to break the curse is to marry one of her own kind, she meets a number of suitors, but all reject her. Two devious men, one with a grudge against the family, hire a man, played by James McAvoy, to pose as a suitor, but complications arise when he begins to fall in love with Penelope, and she makes a bid for freedom. Okay, Eliza, so that's what Google says. But what is this movie really about?
Look, what this movie is about is fairly straightforward. This movie is a fairy tale that ends with the moral that you need to accept yourself and the people around you rather than caring about being accepted by the people around you, which is fairly straightforward, but I feel like they go about it in a sort of more modern twist kind of a way of getting to that fairly typical point.
Yeah, and I think that what you pointed out in the beginning of the episode about how this is sort of a Beauty and the Beast adaptation to that end is sort of intriguing. Because, of course, the Beauty and the Beast fairy tale, the moral of that story is that your inner beauty is the thing that makes you truly beautiful. Mm-hmm. But in this film, the moral is much more geared towards a kind of superficial appearance philosophy, which is that you have to accept the way you look as who you are, even if other people hate it. And I'm not sure how I feel about that adaptation. What did you think?
Well, it's interesting because I think that that's not necessarily what the movie's trying to say, but I do think it's what it says. Because I think it's going for a traditional Beauty and the Beast. Like, you know, he falls for her because of her inner beauty. You know, he falls for her personality and all this kind of stuff. And she falls for him because he's the right fit for her, even though he's not a blue blood. But like the point it makes more is that you will be beautiful if you accept yourself rather than like, you know, being more about the personality thing. So it gets a little muddled, but it is interesting because like we said, it's sort of a Beauty and the Beast adaptation, sort of an original fairy tale. And I'd be curious to hear sort of your thoughts on that, because I would argue that it definitely has all of the plot beats of the traditional Beauty and the Beast story, but it doesn't necessarily read as like a Beauty and the Beast adaptation in the same way that, say, last week, A Cinderella Story is clearly just Cinderella, but in high school.
Yeah, I think on some level, one of the things I find so charming about this movie is that it is like a patchwork pastiche of every kind of classic, Grimm or Perrault, or Hans Christian Andersen type fairy tale, where it's typically centered on the journey of a young woman, which I really appreciate, and her kind of like coming into her own in an uncertain world. And it has like shades of Alice in Wonderland with the mirror, and it has shades of Rapunzel with, at one point, James McAvoy's character says, "Penelope, Penelope, let me in." You know, there are all these like great little references if you're a lover of fairy tales. But there is something kind of original about the way I think Penelope as a character is situated in the story, just because, as you said, what's interesting about her and what I also find kind of anticlimactic about the movie is that she kind of accepts herself from the beginning.
Right. Like, she doesn't say the words, I like myself how I am, until the end, at which point they become the magic words. But she does, she's very confident in who she is. You know, her parents keep trying to set her up with these boys who are behind the glass, and she continually keeps coming out and making the boys look at her, knowing they're going to run away from the start, which partly, I think, is a defense mechanism thing, but also it's partly because she's not willing to lie about who or what she is. So it's a different sort of understanding of the Beast than, like, in a Disney Beauty and the Beast, where he's like, don't even look at me, I don't want anyone to know about this. Like, she'd rather go out into the world and be herself from the start. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, then what's really holding her back? Is it just the physical barrier of her parents?
Yeah, that's what I kind of wondered too. And I think it's to the script's detriment. Because really, my criticisms of this film aren't even so much about his ideology, although I want to get a little bit into the resonances that it has with some disability discourse that I think are sticky at times.
Yep.
But my real criticism is from a dramaturgical or like a literary perspective, because I just think that in pursuit of making Penelope a really like agent character in her own life, you know, being, like you said, very confident, very secure in herself, knowing what she wants and kind of going for it, it makes the plot and the narrative really not the most compelling, I think, because the tension, any tension that arises in the plot, we find out later, was always going to resolve itself anyway. For a variety of reasons. Like, for example, James McAvoy's character, spoilers, we think in the beginning is a blue blood down on his luck, but it turns out he's just a regular guy. So there was never the sort of tension that could have come from him maybe needing to live that blue blood life to get back to it. Again, Penelope always kind of loved herself, so the journey to getting to loving herself was not very tense. Her mother was obsessed with her appearance, but she was never so evil that we were like angry at her, mostly because she's played by Catherine O'Hara, who is eminently charming and likable. So I had concerns about the plot, and there's a part of me that feels like, oh man, that's so sad. Like, are the things that we find really satisfying about a tense fairy tale plot actually not great for the agency of women? Probably.
Probably. Well, and part of the problem, as you start to touch on, is, I think, the lack of a true villain. The closest we get to an evil character is the actual blue blood who's courting her, who believes that she's this hideous beast and continually is telling everyone, like, no, she's got this pig snout and these fangs and she's terrible, and he's trying to one-up her in order to regain his clout amongst the blue blood society. But he's not the thing that is standing in her way for her plot. He's a side evil character, but he's the closest to an actual villain that we have. And so I think that the plot does suffer a bit because of that, because the person in her way is the mother, which is the traditional evil character in a lot of fairy tales. But as you say, Catherine O'Hara's character, while problematic, is not evil or cruel. She's misguided and a result of the culture they live in. So there's not as much of that tension because you're not actively rooting against someone who needs to be destroyed in order for the protagonist to succeed. You're rooting against someone who's kind of this mediocre white man who's whining in the corner and is frustrating and annoying, but not really affecting the plot all that much.
Yes, and I was frustrated too by the fact that James McAvoy's character could have become a sort of secondary villain a la She's All That Bet plot, where in the beginning of the film, he's collaborating with this photographer, played by Peter Dinklage, my God, to get an exclusive photo of Penelope. But he never has to deal with the consequences of that initial betrayal, which I found very disappointing from a tension standpoint.
Yeah, the biggest consequence he has to deal with is that he feels forced to give her up and then is sad about it. But in being sad about it, he also overcomes his current gambling addiction and gets back into writing music, you know, and so in the end, it actually all sort of, that part of it works out well for him. And I think they did that because they wanted him to be a really likable character and they wanted the tension to come from their individual, like, sadness rather than from actual consequences. But that is a harder sell when it comes to actually driving the story forward. That being said, I really like his character. I like the character of Max/Johnny. I think that James McAvoy plays him really charmingly. And I don't mind him as a character. I just wish that there was a little something more to their interactions other than the classic rom-com. They didn't talk about what was really happening, and so there was a misunderstanding, and now they're both sad. Like, I hate that trope in storytelling. If you can genuinely fix the plot just by making the two characters talk to each other, it's not a strong plot. Mm-hmm. You know, and there was some explanation for why they weren't talking in this one. You know, he's embarrassed and sad and trying to help her, you know, so it wasn't quite as bad as some like really truly horrendous romantic comedies where you're just like, there's literally no reason that this person didn't just explain the misunderstanding. Like, there is a reason he didn't explain it. I just don't think it's a great reason.
Yeah, I agree that that was a real weak point in the plot structure as a whole, maybe the weakest.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly my biggest criticism. And like I said, I really like the movie. I enjoy it. I find a lot of the characters very charming. I find the way the story is told very charming. But its biggest problem is just this lack of magical, dangerous tension that you want from a fairy tale, because you want there to be real stakes. And the stakes in the end turn out not to be stakes at all, because what they thought would break the curse isn't even what was needed to break the curse. So why did we spend so much time focusing on it?
Exactly. And in general, I think that your point about it kind of not having that dark tension is really key. I mean, there's a reason why Grimm fairy tales and all of the classic fairy tales involve some level of like mortal danger. And in fact, this movie in the beginning, when I was taking my notes, I was noting that the beginning is quite dark. I mean, the origin mm-hmm. of the curse is very dark. I mean, you have a servant in the household of the Wilhern family who's impregnated by the, you know, prodigal son or whatever. And then she throws herself off a cliff. That's incredibly dark. And then her mother curses the family for that, like, horrible tragedy. That's the kind of thing you expect from a fairy tale. You know, you expect the threat of bodily harm. You mm-hmm. expect, you know, peril, children in peril. But there's not so much of that. And instead, what we get, I think, is something that is very much of its time. And that's something I actually really want to ask you about. And it is, it comes in this form of question. Eliza, in less than 500 words, could you elucidate all the ways in which James McAvoy's character is peak 2007?
So you want 500 words on his haircut?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, he's peak sad boy. It's really amazing. And my little teen heart is so in love with him still. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, that time period was like, he's so peak sad boy. He's, you know, a sensitive musician with a dark past who's like, at first he's motivated by money, but is instantly willing to drop that motivation when he meets the manic pixie dream girl of his dreams, and he's suddenly willing to give up everything just to support what it is she needs. Meanwhile, he's like got this little punk rock edge where he's this musician who used to play at this, like, you know, scummy bar, and he, you know, tells her that she needs to enter the world because she needs to, like, go have a real beer and all this kind of stuff. I mean, he's such a little, like, 2007 punk rock hipster. Which isn't necessarily a bad thing.
No, I mean,
but it is a very particular thing.
I feel like at every 5 minutes or so, I kept writing down, like, I both love and hate how much this is 2007. Because, you know, like, we were in high school in 2007, and that time of your life really puts an impression on you. And so, yes, like, I resonated with so many of these things. Like, that fucking, like, dress jacket, that dress coat that she wears is, like, the most. With all the buttons, oh my god. Did I try and buy something like that at Urban Outfitters? Absolutely. That scarf she wears? Yes. Does James McAvoy wear a fedora unironically? You bet he does.
Yeah. I mean, technically, let's be clear about this. He wears a trilby. Okay. This is gonna come up again, because this is one of the hills that I'm going to die on. A fedora has a taller hat and a wider brim and is worn more in the 40s. Most of the things that in this century we refer to as a fedora is a trilby, and that is the hat of 2000s douche bros.
Well, you heard it here first, fedora tippers. You're actually trilby tippers. You're welcome.
If you're wearing a real fedora, I'm probably willing to give you more props, because you had to really search for that. Also, fun fact that has nothing to do with anything, but the reason fedoras went out of style is because as more and more people had cars, they were too tall to fit into the car, so people started wearing shorter and then no hats.
That is hilarious and adorable.
This has been Fashion History with Eliza. But yes, he does have his little black musician fedora that he puts on every time he is a sad boy.
Mm-hmm. And I think that all of its like extreme 2007 hipster indiness is actually a really important sort of thing from a cultural history standpoint. And here's why. So when we're talking about 2007, of course, we might have some younger listeners listening, but if you were a young person in this time period, you could not escape the reputation of celebutantes like Paris Hilton, like a early days Kim Kardashian, the Olsen twins, etc. So what this film is kind of an intertextual conversation with that's not obvious coming from 2020 is this whole like tabloid obsession, everyone becoming obsessed with Penelope once she reveals her nose, and this kind of like opposition against superficial beauty is very much of its time. And I think putting itself in opposition to the kind of mainstream pop culture at that moment, up to and including the fact that it has a soundtrack of almost laughably cliche indie darlings now at this point. Like the fact that the last song is Sigur Rós is like so ridiculous. Right. From a 2020 standpoint, but it was beautiful then, and it was really subversive, and it was a lot more oppositional than we might see it now.
Well, and I find the paparazzi commentary in this movie very interesting, because it's not the, like, Britney Spears lucky, oh, having the paparazzi around you all the time is the worst and it'll ruin your life version of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, Penelope benefits from the paparazzi quite a bit, actually, once she puts herself out there. They, you know, at first they're a little sort of, as her mother says, just, you know, staring at the pig. But then they seem to really enjoy her, and she benefits from it. She makes a group of friends everywhere she goes. People, like, want to buy her drinks and play games with her and hang out and ask her questions about her life. And for someone who's been cooped up her entire life, this is really exciting. Because, yeah, it's a little bit of a circus show, but it's a circus show in which she gets to call a lot of the shots and she gets to benefit from it. Which I found to be not usually what the commentary on paparazzi is. You know, there's definitely also the elements in the story where it's damaging to her family or where people mm-hmm. are using her for their own benefit. But she, in a early Kim Kardashian type of way, manages to find how to take this grim fascination with her and use it to her own benefit, which is quite forward thinking.
Well, and I wonder, Eliza, if, because I just looked it up to be sure, but I'm now reminded that 2007 was the year of Britney Spears' public breakdown. So, interestingly enough, we have a lot of threads here with paparazzi and the issue of visible disabilities. And I'm wondering what do you think about the fact that the film is sort of setting up the paparazzi in this, like, somewhat smart way, and Penelope as someone who can, like, smartly maneuver them? And do you think that that is setting Penelope up as not like other girls?
Well, I think it can be. I don't think it is, though, because one of the things that I really find fascinating about this movie is that the executive producer is Reese Witherspoon, mm-hmm. who, if you've watched the movie, you know, plays the best friend character, the side character. And this was her first foray into having full creative control over a movie. She'd technically been listed as a producer on Legally Blonde 2. But in the way that you make the lead actor the producer because they're contributing some money and have a little input into their character. This one, she was genuinely the producer. She got it started. She got the funding for it. She did a lot of the casting. Like, she's got creative control over this. And this is right at that period where Reese Witherspoon was starting to change her own storyline, right? Like, now she's well known for producing a lot of female-led dramas and movies. And, you know, right after this, she did Wild and a bunch of stuff like that. And she, who had been a child actor and a teen actor, clearly had to deal with paparazzi and the media and the public perception of her. She'd been in Legally Blonde right when she really became an adult rather than a teen. And I think that colored a lot of how people expected her to behave and be, because she was this, like, perfect, perky blonde girl. And I find it really interesting that her first real foray into producing was this kind of quirky, offbeat story where it's not the traditional sort of romantic lead, and she does not play the type of character that we've seen her play up to this point. And I think that a lot of that gets pulled into the actual story of Penelope as well, with this sort of interest in defining your own story to the press.
That's really interesting to think that maybe that this was an avenue for Reese Witherspoon to think about, you know, as I think she's done throughout her career, smartly adapting to expectations rather mm-hmm. than breaking them down entirely, a la Legally Blonde. That's right. That's a good point.
She's not always fighting the paparazzi perception of her, but she's finding ways to use it to advantage herself and also other women, which is something that she's worked really hard on in her career, and I really admire in her. So I think it's interesting that this is the movie that she makes that debut in, because I think you can see a lot of that in the actual story. And I will say I love her character in this movie, because, again, she had creative control over this. She could have been any kind of character she wanted, and she chose to be this, like, funky punk on a moped mm-hmm. who, like, wears a silly bee costume to the Halloween party at the end and is always, like, shooting off at the mouth. And, you know, I just think it's really interesting that that's what she wanted to be in this film.
Yeah, it was a very surprising turn for her, and I really appreciated it, because I don't think she's played a part like this ever again, really.
No. No, you know, with Pretty Little Lies and stuff, she's still gone back to that, like, very put together, you know, mm-hmm. upper middle class, if not upper class, blonde, perfect, you know, whatever. And I feel like that's been a lot of the perception of her over the years and a lot of the parts she's played. So I always enjoy when she does something that's a little grittier.
There, in terms of the performances in this film, I have to give props to Reese Witherspoon and her team put together an unbelievable cast mm-hmm. for this film. And I was consistently wowed by the people that they were able to bring in, because they were clearly people that wanted to do this film with Reese Witherspoon because it was a fun script and, you know, great opportunity to work with great people. I mean, Catherine O'Hara and Peter Dinklage in this film are really wonderful. I mean, really wonderful.
They really are. And I do feel neither one of them is used to their full potential. But I think that also speaks to the movie, because they could have gotten actors who this is the full potential for them. And instead right. they got really, really A-list, fine, high-class actors and let them fill the roles as was needed. And I think that that's one of the things that does carry this, despite the sort of simple plot. They're all acting their hearts out the whole time and giving you A-plus performances, which I appreciate.
I do want to say this, though, and I want to see what your read was when you were watching it, is I think the presence of Peter Dinklage in this film and the way that his character is deployed in the plot really, it invites a reading of this film as about a person with a disability.
There's some very interesting, I would say, disability and gender politics happening in this film, mm-hmm. and I don't know that the film comes to a conclusion about them, which, as I every time I rewatch the movie, I find more and more frustrating. Because, you know, you've got Penelope, who has this pig snout and these weird ears and can't go into public, and there's this implication that, like, she would be physically incapable of interacting with the world normally yeah. because of how she looks, which, on a surface level, is obviously about, like, beauty standards for women, but also, I think, is a commentary on disability in our culture, because it's often viewed as something that is ugly, unattractive, unappealing, dangerous, scary. You know, all of the things that are how people interact with Penelope in this movie are the things that people with disabilities often find is how the world interacts with them. But meanwhile, then you've got Peter Dinklage, who is a dwarf or a little person, and also at the beginning of the movie loses one of his eyes, and so is wearing an eye patch, mm-hmm. which are both things that are seen within our culture as elements of disability, as conditions that are to be treated as not normal, as debilitating, as, you know, whatever it is, even though they are not. But he, within the context of the story, does not really seem to have difficulties due right. to these conditions. Like, obviously he wishes he didn't lose his eye and he's pissed about it, but you never see that anyone's, like, treating him differently or that he's unable to hold a job. He's a very successful journalist, you know, all these kind of things. And so I don't know if the movie is trying to say that being an ugly woman is worse in society than being a man with a disability, or if they are trying to say that both of these are versions of disability that make living in our culture difficult, but that they don't fully get there. You know, there's something there. I just can't quite define it.
I think what you're getting at is that there's a mixed metaphor in this film, and that mm-hmm. is part of why it doesn't work. So from one angle, you have Catherine O'Hara, who's clearly, as you said, selling that Penelope's nose and pig features are supposed to be representative of, like, female ugliness and the female grotesque. You know, there's that scene. There's this amazing back and forth where she says, you're not your nose, Penelope. And Penelope says, but it is my nose. And then her mother says, you're just somebody else inside waiting to come out.
Right.
Which feels like very much a familiar plastic surgery narrative that was especially popular during the aughts, when, you know, things like Nip Tuck were very popular cultural products. But at the same time, there's this one really subtle, and I thought to me was the most interesting scene in the movie, where Penelope calls up Peter Dinklage's character and says, hey, I'm going to sell you photos of myself because, like, screw it. I have nothing to lose. And why not? You want my photos? Take them. And she says, you know, there, you'll get to have your freak. And he says, well, no one said anything about a freak.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment of kind of connection about their, both of their kind of infreakments in the normative society in which we live, is this really interesting moment of connection between the two of them, where they seem to kind of acknowledge that, like, the standards for what a normal body is are wrong.
Yeah.
And that is the moment where he becomes more sympathetic to her. Now, as you said, what that could be saying about the general concept of a normative body vis-a-vis beauty standard is intriguing, but the movie doesn't quite nail the interweaving of those ideas.
Yeah, well, and that scene is really one of those moments when Peter Dinklage is really acting very hard. Like, he's giving it his all in that scene. There's so much nuance in this, like, three-line exchange between the two of them where they're not even on camera together. They're speaking on the phone. Mm-hmm. And it makes you long for a slightly more complex version of the story where you know more about him and where you get more of their interactions, you know, and because of this interaction he has with her, she sends the pictures. He's realizes that she's not this grotesque that she has been described as, and, you know, and sees that even for the most part, the culture seems to accept her despite the visuals. He becomes much more empathetic to her and is ultimately the one who enables her to get back together with Johnny. Like, he actually pushes that part of the plot forward because of the sympathy and the empathy he feels for her. But just because that happens in the plot doesn't really mean that we get that much about what he's going through as that happens. And so it is a little unclear just what they're trying to say, other than these two differently bodied people have some sort of a connection. But meanwhile, he participated in the othering of her and, you know, and the freakifying of her whole life, trying to get these photos and out her family for having this strange pig-like daughter. I just don't know. Are we meant to really feel sympathy for him in the end, or are we meant to see his hypocrisy and be angry at him for it?
Yeah, I don't know. I wish that the film kind of pushed us in one direction or the other. I think you're right. It's sort of like what happens with Johnny, James McAvoy's character, is that he doesn't have to deal with any consequences from his behavior earlier in the film. It's just sort of like, well, that happened and people know better now and everything's cool.
Yeah, and there's also an interesting class thing that's happening throughout this movie, which is very clearly set up on purpose, right? Like, it's supposed to be sort of the average Joe versus the blue bloods. Yeah. And I don't disagree with their portrayal of wealthy, aristocratic, upper class, white, you know, society and its obsession with specific beauty standards and specific expectations for families and for social interactions. But by the end, it is very much like the rich, haughty people got what was coming to them, and all of the working class people get to just be happy. And it's very simplistic in that narrative. You know, even the whiny white boy, like, he gets what's coming to him, I guess, in that he doesn't, like, succeed in the eyes of his father. But that's it. Like, there's no real consequences that we know about through the movie of what happens to him, nor do Penelope or Johnny or any of the other characters who are clearly shown to us as, like, the relatable ones get revenge on him in any way. You know, right? It's not like they do something which hurts him. It's just that, like, he gets what we wish rich white boys would get, which is nothing. Like, which is, like, it's nice to see in the moment, but as an actual story device, there's just not a lot that happens there.
Yeah, and I would, again, chalk that up to the moment in which this film was made, especially American culture had a very weird relationship to class and wealth. Because at the time, American culture was incredibly materialistic. I mean, we might think American culture is materialistic now, but then in 2007, we're talking about the era of, like, everybody needed the, you know, the T-Mobile sidekick, and it needed to be covered in rhinestones, and you needed to have your Air Force One sneakers, and everybody was obsessed with the acquisition of wealth. MTV Cribs, you know, VH1's the Fabulous Life, right? So there was this this pop culture obsession with the rich, and underlying it was always this criticism of, wow, they're so superficial, that's so terrible, they should care more about inner beauty. But it was never actually a criticism of the acquisition of wealth itself as a violent thing, right? As a requiring right. oppressing other people.
Yeah, no, you get this like obsession with things like The Simple Life, where it's laughing at, you know, Paris Hilton and saying like, look at how ridiculous she is and over the top and out of touch, but at the same time, like, we're giving her boatloads of money to be on this show and entertain us by letting us have this tiny glimpse into her rich life. It's, you know, it's like the not popular girl hating the popular girl but really wanting to be her was yes. like the entire culture at that moment.
Yes. And the dramatic irony of that looking back is that the very next year the economy mm-hmm. crashed.
Right. I mean, this is post-90s, still in that, you know, that high of consumerism, but right before the giant 2008 crash. Mm-hmm. So it's literally the peak of that, because it's right before we hit the edge and toppled over the side. Not to say we're not ridiculous consumers now who are also obsessed with wealth. Keeping Up with the Kardashians has been going on for 14 years. But
My God.
But even that's ending. But, you know, it's a different... It was a different cultural moment than what we're experiencing now, or what we've experienced at all in the last decade.
Yeah, and I think that maybe a good place to wrap is that the end of the movie, that last scene I found so charming, whatever his name is, Johnny and Penelope are sitting on the hill and they're talking to all of Penelope's students and telling them the story of their fairy tale romance. And then they ask, well, what does it mean? And then the kids all raise their hand and offer up their answers. In a way, I guess, saying that the filmmakers don't want you to come up with a moral for this particular fairy tale, as if that's like critique of fairy tales. I don't know that it is, but I guess, Eliza, if you had to say what the moral of Penelope is, given that it's a original fairy tale, what would you say that it is?
Well, I mean, as I said at the beginning, the intended moral is you have to find beauty inside yourself. I think the moral that it really gives is you've got to find the world that you fit into. And once you find that, then you'll fit in, and within that context, be beautiful and cool and popular and all that kind of stuff. So it's a grayer version of that moral.
Because in the end, don't be confused. Being beautiful and cool and popular is the important thing.
Right. It's just whether or not you're beautiful and cool and popular to, like, wealthy aristocratic England or cool, gritty, bar-hopping London.
The choice is yours, listeners. All right. Well, that was our analysis of Penelope, but definitely slide into our DMs on Instagram, make some comments on Facebook, and let us know what you thought. Before we tell you our antidotes for this week's show, as always, we want to give a shout out to our romantic leads on Patreon who keep the podcast going. We love you. Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey, you are the best. Thank you.
And this week's episode is brought to you by GeeksterPets.com. Geekster Pets is a website where you can go and buy absolutely adorable geek-themed bandanas for your dogs and cats. They're really cute. They're all made by the business owner, Lydia, who's a dog mom from Texas, who has two dogs named Zuko and Azula. So she's a fellow geek just like the rest of us. They have all kinds of cool patterns and prints that you can get, including a bunch of Geekster exclusive prints designed by Lydia that you cannot get anywhere else. They all of the bandanas are reversible, so you get two different patterns with each bandana, and they close with plastic snaps that have 5 inches of adjustability, so they'll fit your dog no matter what haircut he has right now. Go to geeksterpets.com, that's GEEKSTERPETS.com, or at geeksterpets on Instagram to check out some of the adorable options. So check them out. So there's a lot of poison in this movie to be gotten past, not to dwell on the fairy tale illusions too much. But Janelle, what are your antidotes for this movie?
Eliza, I really appreciate that you classily avoided the poison apple metaphor, but, like,
But I didn't at the same time.
But you didn't at the same time. So my antidote for Penelope is actually a film that came out the same year. And that is sleeper hit cult obsession Stardust, which is based on the novel of the same name by Neil Gaiman. It is also an original fairy tale. It also has a female lead, or a male lead, really, male and female shared lead. It's a wonderful, dark, eccentric, similar kind of patchwork fairy tale story. The book is fabulous, too, if you get a chance to read it. It's fun. It's dark. I find it incredibly compelling. And because it's Neil Gaiman, the world building and the plot is just magnificent. It's one of his better pieces of work, I think. So check that out. Stardust.
Oh, such a great recommendation. And another one that has an unbelievable cast.
Oh, my gosh. Robert De Niro, Michelle Pfeiffer.
Ugh, every scene you turn around and you're like, oh my god, how'd they get them to be in this movie? It's so good. My antidote for this is going to be a two-part miniseries from Sci-Fi, from the Sci-Fi Network, called Alice, which is a modern adaptation of the Alice in Wonderland story. And I feel like it's a good antidote to this because it's got a similar kind of aesthetic in that it's modern, but there's these weird sort of magical realism, old-fashioned-y sort of elements kind of interwoven. But it's actually from 2 years later. It's from 2009, and there is a much stronger sort of anti-capitalist consumerism through line going on. The bad guys, who are also the rich and powerful, I feel like get much more targeted comeuppance at the end, and there's a clearer point of view that it's talking from. So if that's what frustrated you about Penelope, I feel like Alice is a really good solution to that. But it's also really fun and quirky. It's very brightly colored. The two leads have really great chemistry, and you still have a 2000s Twinkie sad boy as the main lead who also wears a trilby.
We love a Twinkie sad boy and a trilby.
So, you know, if you're still feeling for James McAvoy, even though they didn't give him enough to do in this movie, go check out Alice, because there's a very similar character, and I feel like he just has a little bit more heft to his storyline.
That is an amazing antidote, but now I'm stuck on the idea of the trilby tipper instead of the fedora tipper, and I feel like you've changed the internet, Eliza. Like, you've made a serious contribution.
I really hope that it catches on and people stop incorrectly labeling hats. Well, Janelle, this was an excellent discussion of a modern adaptation of a fairy tale.
Yes, thank you. It was an above average conversation about a very average movie. I thank you, Eliza. I thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time.